So what comes next for the two Texans once running for president? Out of the race, but not down for the count. We'll get you up to speed today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The latest on Julian Castro's decision to withdraw from the presidential race and his rapid endorsement of a former rival. Plus, our conversation with Beto O'Rourke on his plans to stay in the political arena. Also, a free ride for Houston, a radical rethink about bus fares, plus signs of a big comeback for the Bighorn out in Big Bend country. There's a whole lot of ground to cover on today's Texas Standard, and we'll get started right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time on this seventh day of January 2020. I'm David Brown, and it's great to have you with us. Just 7 days into the new year, and we've so far had a panic over a potential World War III, a week of seismic activity in Puerto Rico, culminating in a 6.4 magnitude quake, and some political developments rocking the Democratic race for the White House. Former San Antonio mayor and former HUD secretary Julian Castro is now also a former candidate for president. Now, in case you missed it, Mr. Castro launched his new year with an announcement that underscored the obvious. His campaign for Democratic nomination lacked the money and the poll numbers to pull off a victory. But that doesn't mean he didn't pull off something else. As The Atlantic notes this week, Castro became a more intriguing political personality. And as a young person, by political standards, his hour might still be to come. Indeed, as Castro himself conceded to Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies, the San Antonio native's far from finished with national politics. In fact, his latest move is the endorsement of a former rival.
At the now-defunct Castro for President campaign headquarters in the Fine Silver Building in San Antonio, the optimistic posters, streamers, and slogans remain on the walls. They are still declaring that this is Castro country and that Julian is the future. Even though Castro is no longer in the hunt for the Democratic presidential nomination, the slogans can still be seen as true, just not right now.
I could tell that this just isn't our time. I learned that in 2005 when I lost the mayor's race. That wasn't my time. And I feel like that now.
Looking back on his campaign, Castro said he did not compromise in how we spoke about the issues.
Whether it's police reform or homelessness or kids that are caught up in a foster care system that's broken or migrants that are seeking a better life.
But was that a failed strategy? Were these loser issues, since obviously Castro isn't going to be the nominee?
The issues that people consider quote-unquote loser issues now often become the issues that people campaign on and win on in the future. And I believe that's going to come to pass.
Castro says a main reason his campaign didn't find its wings is because the central concern for many is beating incumbent Republican Donald Trump.
Right now, there is a sense that, hey, we just need to get this guy out of office. This president is uniquely bad president.
And Castro says he's going to do his part to do that.
Whoever wins the nomination, I'm going to be there. Whatever they need, I'm going to help make sure that I'm there.
But Castro wants that nominee to be Elizabeth Warren. On Monday, he announced that he is endorsing the Massachusetts senator. I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
What Castro's campaign might have lacked is something a fellow Texan once in the same race had in spades. Like few other Texans in recent years, save Beyonce perhaps, a certain former congressman from El Paso became so well known by his first name alone that no one has ever asked us which Beto we're talking about. For the record, it's the one who came very close to toppling an incumbent Republican senator in 2018 and who subsequently launched his own presidential campaign and closed it down too in 2019. So, now what? Well, perhaps we should ask the man himself. Former Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke joins us. Mr. O'Rourke, thanks for coming on the Texas Standard.
It's an honor to be with you. I listen to you every day, and it's great to actually be on the show.
That's very nice of you to say. It's good to hear. I want to get to some of what you've been up to since you let go of the your Democratic presidential bid. Shortly after you dropped out, you announced Powered by People. Could you tell us a little bit more about what Powered by People is?
Powered by People is all about bringing our fellow Texans together to decide the most important elections of our lifetimes. And we're specifically focused right now on the state legislative races. As you and your listeners know, Republicans hold a 9-person majority, or in other words, Democrats only need to pick up 9 seats to hold a majority in the state house for the first time since 2001. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly important in 2020 as we will reapportion the districts in Texas. And as you may know, Texas is one of the most gerrymandered states in the union and has produced one of the lowest voter turnout rates in the country. So anything that you might care about, whether it's gun violence or climate change or access to healthcare, can only be decided through our representatives. And we have a better chance of having change on those issues if we have representatives who reflect our values and our interests. So Powered by People is about bringing everyday Texans into volunteer opportunities in these state house races so that we pick up these 9 seats and once again have a majority in the state legislature that represents our interests and our values.
But I'm curious, though, because I seem to recall you campaigned against political action committees when you ran for U.S. Senate in 2018 and your presidential race, too, right? This is what makes Powered by People different from other PACs?
So this is not an organization that will make contributions to individual candidates. This is an organization that uses its resources to mobilize volunteers, to knock on doors and make phone calls and do the kind of direct engagement with voters that is fundamental to our democracy mm-hmm. and any chance that we'll have to win these elections.
But I want to ask you about, you mentioned those 9 seats in the Texas State House and the fact that Texas is highly gerrymandered by Republicans. My question is why you think that those 9 seats are especially vulnerable. Is it something about where they are? Is it something about the changing demographics in Texas? I mean, the districts have not changed.
There are 17 seats represented by Republicans in the state house, and those Republicans won those seats by a margin of under 10 points. So it's within reach. 9 of those seats, I actually won those districts in the 2018 race. So we've actually done it before. So we know that we can do it again. And then when you think about the fact that you've got the House Democratic Campaign Committee that's led by Representative Celia Israel, flipped the Texas House, great candidates like Eliz Markowitz and HD 28 in Fort Bend. This is not only very possible, we've done it before, and I think we'll do it again. And we'll be able to get more than just those 9 seats. I think all 17 of those seats won by Republicans with a margin under 10 points are vulnerable and winnable by us in this year.
Now, when you were running for Senate, a lot of people were enthusiastic about Democrats' prospects, and you saw everyone saw the yard signs and commented on how well you did against the incumbent Republican there. Question is, with Donald Trump now running for re-election and the field of Democratic candidates not quite sorted out just yet, how does that cut here in Texas?
It's a great question. You know, when I was a candidate for the nomination to run against Donald Trump, part of the premise was Texas, with 38 electoral college votes, our state and a Texan at the top of the ballot could do more than any other to defeat Donald Trump and do so unequivocally, without any question about the margin in the electoral college. I think that logic still holds. And if we do the necessary organizing work with Powered by People and other allied organizations across the state to mobilize voters in what has historically been a low turnout state and turn out proportionate to our true numbers, we can help whoever the Democratic nominee is for president defeat Donald Trump in Texas. We can also help the U.S. Senate nominee defeat John Cornyn. So I think this power is going to flow up from these state house races. And instead of coattails from a presidential nominee or a big name political celebrity, it's going to be the hard work of everyday Texans knocking on doors, making phone calls that makes that possible.
But some people would say it wouldn't have to be that way. Now, I'm going to get in a ton of trouble here for asking you this question, but I have to anyway. We always hear from listeners who say, well, wait, stop pushing Beto O'Rourke on this question of he should have taken on John Cornyn. Right. And because you were pretty emphatic that was not going to be part of the game plan. And yet there are a lot of Democratic operatives who think that you would have had quite a good quite a good chance of taking him down. Why did you decide not to?
I really wanted to run for president and felt very strongly, again, that what we were able to do together in Texas in 2017 and 2018 could hold the key to what we wanted to do in 2020 nationally, organizing people from all walks of life, regardless of their differences, whether it's party affiliation or who it is they love or pray or how many generations they've been in this country, defining ourselves not as Republicans or Democrats, but Americans first. That's the key not only to defeating Donald Trump, but to making sure that this country's up to the greatest set of challenges that we have ever faced. I was also very mindful of the fact that in a state of 28 million, certainly there is someone else who can run for Senate and do so successfully against John Cornyn. And I still feel very strongly that out of a very talented field of potential nominees, we're going to have somebody who will defeat John Cornyn and represent us in a way in the U.S. Senate that we can be proud of in our state.
Former Congressman, former Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke has launched Powered by People, a new political action committee. Mr. O'Rourke, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Very nice to get a chance to say hello.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much, David.
Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Already hearing from lots of folks about our talk with Beto O'Rourke, his plans to boost Democrats at the federal and state level, and hopes to help flip the Texas House blue. On Facebook, Joey Corker calls O'Rourke's newfound support of political action committees, which he previously disdained, weird. I guess it's just the PACs they don't start that they dislike, he writes. And Marvin Crane asks why O'Rourke continues to receive attention despite his political track record. However, via Twitter, Ghosty Most counts themselves as very excited that O'Rourke's return to politics is happening, and Punk Rockers Vote, I think that might be an allusion there to Beto's old past there, tweets that the latest initiative from O'Rourke is very important. Lots of folks sounding off about this one and lots of other stories from social media. I'll be back with more reactions later in the show, including that continuing turmoil in the Middle East that definitely has a lot of our friends and listeners concerned.
New York Times reporting that dozens are dead and hundreds hurt at the funeral of that Iranian general who was assassinated by the U.S. drone last week. We'd like to know what's on your news radar. Why don't you tweet us right now at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for your comments, and he's going to be joining us back on the big broadcast in about 35 minutes or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, providing visitors a glimpse into the past on Museum Day, January 25th and 26th, with 11 museums, including Bishop's Palace, the Naval Museum, and Moody Mansion. Details at galvestonmuseumday.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Outside of California, it's hard to think of a state more attached to car transport than Texas. Okay, pickup trucks, but you get the idea. What would it take to get people out of their vehicles and onto buses? What about free rides? Free rides. Houston's Metro service is considering the possibility, and as Houston Public Media's Gail DeLauder discovered, so are transit advocates.
If you ride a local Metro bus in Harris County, it'll probably cost you $1.25. There are also some half-price fares for students and seniors, and also people with disabilities. But what if you didn't have to pay any fare at all?
It could have increased ridership, reduced traffic congestion, increased air quality, faster travel times, reduced drunk driving.
That's Tori Gaddis with the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. He also writes a transportation blog, Houston Strategies.
If we were able to reduce or eliminate these fares, how many more riders would we get on these HOV buses, and how much would that potentially reduce traffic congestion on the freeways?
The bulk of Metro's operating funds don't come from those fares. The transit agency gets most of its money from a 1 cent sales tax. And that has the attention of someone else who's advocating for free or reduced fares. That's Harris County Precinct 3 Commissioner Steve Raddick.
The reality is we don't have near enough people using the transit we can provide.
Braddock points out that providing a financial incentive might be what it takes to get more people on board.
We just keep going the way we're going. We're going to continue to build more freeways. We're going to continue to do other forms of transportation. But it makes no sense to have buses that are only partially full running around.
Transit ridership has been mostly flat over the past year, but Metro hopes to boost those numbers through a package of long-term improvements. Voters just approved a $3.5 billion bond issue to help pay for it. Metro Chairman Karin Patman says while fares aren't a huge part of their budget, they'd have to figure out a way to make up that money if they stop charging riders.
There are unanticipated consequences of a free fare policy that we just need to fully consider before we went to it.
And that's what concerns Ani Blair. She heads a transportation advocacy group, Link Houston. Blair says to get more riders, Metro needs to put its focus on other issues.
Does the bus come on time? Because if I'm trying to schedule my day, I need to get there on time and know what to predict. Can I wait in dignity at a shelter that is accessible and safe for me?
And Blair says all those things cost money.
The loss of revenue from the fares would undermine their other access to improving operations, improving customer service, improving all of those things. So if they don't have that revenue, they can't address the things that people want.
Metro's financial analysts are currently looking at whether the agency should reduce or eliminate fares. And the board is waiting to get a report. We asked Tory Gaddis what he'd like to hear.
I am hopeful that Metro will be willing to at least try it. In the short term, they could definitely experiment with it during off-peak hours. I know there's some concern that during peak hours, there might be so much demand that they wouldn't have the capacity, and then you have people waiting for buses. And so they want to make sure they kind of do this in a thoughtful, incremental way.
Metro officials say if they do move ahead with free or reduced fares, they'd start with a pilot program, and it wouldn't all happen at once. In Houston, I'm Gail DeLauder for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, today officials in Australia reported that police have so far arrested 183 people in connection with the devastating brush fires there. Blame for the deaths of at least 25 and nearly 20 million acres are reported to have burned. This has been going on since September, with nearly 200 bushfires still burning across southeast Australia and worsening dry conditions, spelling out, a very unpleasant situation for firefighters, including many from the U.S. helping out there. They may be battling more fires by this weekend. Now, here in Texas, where drought conditions are almost considered a way of life, one must wonder whether there are lessons to be learned from what's happening half a world away. John Nielsen Gammon is the state climatologist at Texas A&M University. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
From what I gather, and when I'm sure from what you have noticed over the years, a lot of people sort of seem to take drought for granted in Texas. Certainly a lot of urban Texans do. How are we faring right now?
Well, at the moment, we've got drought across a pretty large swath of the state. Mostly, we're talking about northeast corner on down through Austin and San Antonio and over to Del Rio and Laredo. It's about 25-30% of the state in drought right now, but the worst areas toward the southwest near the Rio Grande.
Do you see any changes that seem to be coming to drought patterns in Texas?
Well, rainfall historically has actually gone up about 5 or 10%, especially in the eastern part of the state.
Huh.
The west hasn't seen an uptick. But, of course, temperatures matter, too, because the hotter it gets, the faster the water leaves the soil, the drier things are. And temperatures right now across the state have been trending upward. They're running about 1.5 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the 20th century average. So when things do dry out, the impacts tend to be worse than they used to be.
And so if you were to, say, sound an alarm over, you know, what officials should be taking special note of, where would you point in Texas? I would imagine it sounds like you're suggesting that perhaps West Texas is more at risk for the sort of, well, the sort of a fire danger that perhaps they're seeing in Australia right now.
Yeah, since it's been dry so far in parts of West Texas, the fire risk is elevated. In Texas, we have sort of two fire seasons. One starts about this time of year and runs through April. When places have been dry during the winter and we get those strong cold fronts or even some dry air coming from the west, fires get ignited can spread very rapidly. We saw a lot of that during 2011, for example. And then in the summertime, we can get fires that burn in more of the central and eastern parts of the state that when we have short-term drought, but those don't tend to spread so rapidly. The exception to that was 2011 when we had the hurricane fanning the flames. So fortunately, that's one difference from us in Australia. They get strong winds and strong cold fronts even in the summer. Fortunately, the time we're hottest is different from the time we get the strong winds, so we're not quite as vulnerable.
Is what's happening in Australia, should we consider that a kind of a warning for us here in Texas, given the fact that we have such intense drought conditions quite often here?
The fires in Australia are especially intense this year because it's been both dry and hot. And that's why we had lots of fires in 2011 as well. Is maybe a trend in the future, especially in the western part of the state. Some of the projections for fires actually say that the far western Texas may actually see fewer fires simply because there'll be less vegetation growing. But unfortunately, as ecosystems transition from like forest to brushland, the way the old vegetation gets cleared out is by fire. So unfortunately, the period of transition is not often very pretty.
John Nielsen Gammon is the state climatologist at Texas A&M University. Professor, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. You're welcome.
Hey, anybody out there drink Shinerbach? You ever seen that great big old bighorn sheep on the bottle? You ever seen one of those in the wild? Well, you just might. Stick around. We got news on that coming up as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at BecomeACASA.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. American Airlines has reached a settlement with Boeing over the grounding of the airplane maker's 737 MAX jet fleet. KERA's Miguel Perez reports the Texas airline will give some of that money to employees.
American says employees will get $30 million through its profit-sharing program. The amount each employee gets will vary depending on experience. The settlement only covers damages the Fort Worth-based airline incurred last year. American had 24 MAX jets in its fleet and has canceled thousands of flights since the grounding. It's not clear when the MAX will fly again. And Dallas-based Southwest Airlines reached a similar deal with Boeing in December that will make $125 million available to their employees. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Texas Democratic leaders are suing the state over its voter registration rules that require physical signatures on applications. The federal lawsuit filed in San Antonio Monday contends state election officials illegally rejected more than 2,400 applications last year. That's because they included a picture of a voter's signature instead of a physical signature. The forms were filled out online at vote.org and mailed to the Texas Secretary of State's office. Texas Democratic Party spokesman Obi Rahman says Texans in rural areas are affected the most.
A lot of rural voters have to use electronic signatures because they don't have access to mail. So it's a very discriminatory ruling that Republicans made, and it's another attempt of them to alter the election and curb the rising Texas electorate that's going to help the Texas Democratic Party win elections.
The Texas voting lawsuit is the third brought by party leaders in the state and campaign groups for Democrats in the U.S. House and Senate. Texas public health officials have confirmed a third death linked to the national outbreak of severe lung disease among e-cigarette users. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports.
There are 228 Texans with severe lung disease linked to vaping. Health officials say one of them was a Galveston County woman in her early 30s who died on December 29th. Dr. Philip Kaiser is with the Galveston County Local Health Authority.
We're very sad to report this death. I think it's very sobering that we're still seeing deaths from vaping illness. It's a very serious public health threat, and we would encourage people to avoid vaping products if at all possible.
With this latest death in Galveston County, it now brings the total in Texas to 3. 2 others died in North Texas, the most recent confirmed death in Dallas County last week. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Fort Worth-based Pier 1 Imports is closing nearly half of its stores nationwide as it struggles to draw customers and compete online. The home decor company said Monday up to 450 locations will shut down. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. A changing of the guard for what's been called America's team. After 10 seasons at the helm of the Dallas Cowboys, Jason Garrett was relieved of his duties late last week, as many had predicted. But he was quickly replaced just yesterday. Reports surfaced that Garrett would be succeeded by Mike McCarthy, who coached the Green Bay Packers to a Super Bowl win back in 2011. A lot of people making note that this all happened in the span of what appeared to be about 24 to 48 hours, a rather rapidly revolving door indeed. But do not let the swiftness of this decision fool you. Such decisions are not made willy-nilly by teams worth billions of dollars like the Dallas Cowboys. Here to talk about that is Darren Roberts. He's the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, always good to see you, sir. Thanks for stopping by.
Good to see you. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I think it's going to be a good 2020. So Jason Garrett is out and Mike McCarthy is in. Were you surprised at all by how this coaching change kind of played out in Dallas?
So I wasn't, after the Cowboys went 8-8, and obviously in Dallas there's only one goal each year, which is the Super Bowl. You were expecting for the Jones to make a change. Mike McCarthy, many would say, was the number one coach who was out on the market right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, former Super Bowl winner, 125 wins, 77 losses, 13 seasons as a head coach. So you knew that the Cowboys weren't going to go with sort of an upstart new name. They want an established coach to lead this team.
Now, you've been in the NFL coaching ranks in the past, so you know sort of what things are like behind that curtain. What does it mean when you have a coaching change at a team like the Cowboys? I mean, is it, do people have to, people have to readjust to different styles and that sort of thing. But there's going to be, I would imagine, a certain amount of upheaval.
Right. So there's going to be a very stark philosophical shift. Each head coach has not just a playbook, but also a set of ideals and a mission statement. And so there will be a little bit of a sort of a startup phase where this new team will become accustomed to Mike McCarthy. And Mike McCarthy, look, he's a Pittsburgh native, tough nose, hard guy. He's going to coach this team with an iron fist, and it will be very interesting to see how he and Jerry Jones mesh over the course of the next season.
But if you're a player, I mean, in some sense, you're going to wonder if you got a job coming next season, right?
That's the big question. You know, we have the NFL Combine coming up in February, where you'll have all of these college players coming onto the market. If you are a player for the Dallas Cowboys and you have a coaching change, your job is up for grabs, you know, with the exception of the Dak Prescott's and Ezekiel Elliott's. There are some players at the bottom of the roster who are wondering, you know, will I fit into McCarthy's scheme? And so I think the next couple of months will show us the answer to those questions.
I want to ask you about something that you're probably familiar with. It's my understanding that when NFL teams conduct head coaching searches, they're required to interview at least one person of color for the job. This is the Rooney Rule?
The Rooney Rule, yes.
So the Cowboys appeared to have done that. They interviewed longtime Cincinnati Bengals coach Marvin Lewis. But it seems like, I mean, on the surface, that McCarthy was the person they wanted all along. Is the Rooney Rule doing what it's supposed to be doing?
Great question. The Rooney Rule, named after the Pittsburgh Steelers former owner Dan Rooney.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this: when you see a coaching hire where there are two candidates, one's a minority candidate and one is not, that tells you that the team already knew who they wanted and they were able to get him. What I will say is that I think many people have felt that the Rooney Rule has exposed up-and-coming offensive and defensive coordinators of color to owners, right? So there have been some hires in the past. Brian Flores, who is now the head coach with the Dolphins, is one example. These coaches, even though they may not have been at the top of the list for the ownership.
Yeah.
And they maybe didn't get that first interview, right? That they didn't get the hire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The ownership says, this guy's impressive. Let's keep him in mind for future years. There's still a lot of work to be done given the numbers right now, but I think there's really a mixed bag of a story here with the Rooney Rule.
We just have a few seconds left here, but I got to ask you about some actual football. Houston Texans play the Kansas City Chiefs on Saturday, second round of the playoffs. Chiefs are heavy favorites. How much of a chance do you give the Texans here?
Let me tell you something. Deshaun Watson is playing out of his mind. And I tell you, with that guy at quarterback, I think this game is going to be closer than Vegas thinks. Arrowhead Stadium is a tough place to play, but I don't think that this is going to be a game that's going to be there's going to be a big gap. I think it's going to be a close one into the fourth quarter.
I'm kind of pumped up about this.
Yeah, this will be exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Darren Roberts is founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, good to see you again, sir. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Good to see you, Dave.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
I'm David Brown, and this is the Texas Standard. The mountains of West Texas are home to all kinds of critters you won't find anywhere else here in the Lone Star State. Among them, the desert bighorn sheep. You know, the one on a Shiner Bock label? These days, there are about 1,500 bighorns in Texas, although it wasn't that long ago that there were far fewer. And as the Texas Standard's Michael Marks tells us, this just might be the start of something even bigger.
It's a clear, cool morning in West Texas, and about 50 people are watching a helicopter wind its way around the south side of Elephant Mountain, a brown, flat-topped summit about 30 miles south of Alpine. The sun isn't all the way up yet, but it's clear the helicopter is hauling some unusual cargo.
Looks like we got some sheep coming in. Yeah, we got some slung there.
That's Bob Dittmar, state wildlife veterinarian for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and sure enough, he's right. Dangling about 15 feet from the bottom of the helicopter are two desert bighorn sheep. It's early, but they have already had quite a day. The way it works is the helicopter pilot, Earl Waters, spies them on the mountain and flies close enough to the sheep to shoot them with a net. Then an assistant called a mugger jumps out of the helicopter to blindfold the netted sheep and tie their legs together. Once immobilized, the mugger wraps them in a full-body sling, which is then attached to the cord dangling below the helicopter. From there, they're flown to the drop-off point. At the base of the mountain, the helicopter's blades kick up a thick haze as the pilot gingerly lowers the sheep to the ground. They touch down, tip over, and wait. Now, before I tell you what happens next to these sheep, let's back up for some context on why desert bighorns are being helicoptered off Elephant Mountain at all. Again, here's veterinarian Bob Dittmar.
Elephant's been a very successful breed sat and probably combines good habitat, good management, and just probably a little bit of luck.
You could almost say they've been too successful here. There are too many bighorns on Elephant Mountain. There's not enough space or food to support them here. So Texas Parks and Wildlife relocated some of them. It's a huge and complex operation. Parks and Wildlife only relocates bighorns every 5 to 10 years or so, but it's critical to the sheep's long-term survival. The plan is to catch 74 sheep, gather as much data about them as possible, and then release them at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, 50 miles to the southeast.
So it's helping the population here at Elephant by alleviating that browsing pressure and helping that or augment that restoration effort at Black Gap.
That's Froilan Hernandez, the Desert Bighorn Sheep Program Leader for Texas Parks and Wildlife. The present and future health of Texas's bighorns is his responsibility, which is no small task. For as strong as individual bighorns appear, their population is fragile. They're native to West Texas. You can find ancient petroglyphs of them out here. But as recently as the 1960s, there were no bighorns in the state whatsoever. Zero. They were pushed out by ranchers who had moved into the area to raise domestic sheep and goats. The wild sheep died from diseases carried by their domestic cousins, and more ranches meant more fences
that impeded bighorn movement to and from mountain ranges and whatnot.
The ranchers viewed the bighorns as a nuisance and a threat and hunted them with impunity.
There was regulations in place, but really nobody there to enforce them, and so they could be hunting essentially at will.
Ever since bighorns died out in Texas, the state's been trying to bring them back, but it's been a slow process. It's taken 80 years to restore their population to what it was before the wool industry moved in. There's still a long way to go.
Our goal is to repopulate all 17, 18 mountain ranges that are of historic habitat with about 3,000 animals.
Which is why this relocation is so important. Manually spreading bighorns throughout West Texas gives individual herds more room to grow and insulates them from transmittable diseases like pneumonia, which has decimated bighorns in other states. That brings us back to Elephant Mountain. At its base, 50 biologists, veterinarians, and volunteers watch the helicopter drop off the two sheep. Once it flies away, volunteers hustle over.
Can you tilt his nose down that way?
Yep.
Just there?
Like that.
Right.
And carry the bighorns 20 yards to a makeshift biology lab. Tables of syringes, vials, clamps, sterilizing liquid. Tools to squeeze every available bit of biological data out of these sheep. Once they're set down on an examination table, volunteers close in around them, led by veterinarians like Walt Cook of Texas A&M.
When we do a capture event like this, and when Parks and Wildlife does a capture event like this, we try to take advantage of that and get every conceivable sample we think that we need or that we might need in the future.
It's critical to gather the data as quickly as possible while stressing the sheep out as little as possible. Deaths at these capture events are rare, but they do happen. The process starts with taking each bighorn's temperature and a blood sample.
And then go in quick.
Okay.
Go in quick.
They're surprisingly compliant as veterinarians tilt their heads back to slide a long syringe into their jugular. Occasionally, one's breathing gets heavy, but they don't struggle or fight. Although they could. Up close, their strength is obvious. Huge leg muscles designed to propel them up steep cliffs and ridged, curly-cue horns that look like ancient weapons.
105.2, 105.3.
Rising temperatures are a sign of stress, so volunteers keep close watch over the thermometer, calling out each uptick. While this is happening, other volunteers are collecting hair samples and attaching a numbered yellow tag to each of the sheep's ears. Then, after a tonsil swab and getting a radio collar around their neck, the sheep is ready to be loaded into a trailer.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Which can be tricky, since you've got to untie their legs.
Woo! Didn't get kicked.
Over the course of 3 days, 74 bighorns go through this process. At the end of each day, the sheep are then trucked 2.5 hours away to their new home. It's pitch black outside when we arrive at the release site at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area.
Straighten it out.
Each trailer's door faces a rocky hill 30 yards away. Once they're in place, biologist Travis Smith unlatches the first door.
Y'all ready?
Opens it up, and then nothing happens. The first sheep just stands there.
Dale gas.
It takes a little bit of this, but then finally, the first sheep hops out of the trailer, bounds down the road, and fades into the brush. One by one or two by two, the rest of the sheep get released in the same way.
All right, here comes the next one. All
right. A small group of ewes are among the last sheep out of the trailers. Sheep program leader Forlan Hernandez tracks them with a flashlight as they tramp single file through the brush and up the hill.
That's really cool to see them like that. I mean, I get goosebumps every time I get that. It's awesome to see them that way.
It's the first time all day we've seen them move out in the open. They're fast, sure-footed, speeding up as they hit the rocky slope ahead of them. they look right at home out here. In Alpine, I'm Michael Marks for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In Houston, three female sex trafficking victims are suing three major hotel chains in federal court. They say that the hotels aren't doing enough to prevent sex trafficking at their franchises. The lawsuits claim that some of the biggest names in the hotel business should not be insulated from the actions of their franchisees, which the plaintiffs say often turn a blind eye or worse to signs of sex trafficking on their properties. Here to talk about these cases, Houston Chronicle reporter Gabrielle Banks. She covers federal courts. Gabby, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much, David.
It's my understanding that what makes this case unusual is that not just that this has been filed in federal court, but that we're talking about some of the biggest names in the hotel business, Hilton Worldwide, Choice Hotels, and Wyndham Hotels, right?
That's correct.
What is it about the strategy of this case that makes it unique?
The approach of this lawsuit is that sex trafficking is a public health crisis. It's well known and understood. It creates trauma for the people affected by it, and that all the businesses that facilitate it should be held accountable, including the upper echelons of the companies that own these little franchises, where it takes place something like 94% of the time it's happening in hotels.
But, of course, these chains say, we don't own, that's the whole point, we don't own these hotels, right? I mean, that it comes down to liability law.
They do, are responsible because they're part of the chain. The particular hotels in Houston were La Quinta, Comfort Inn, and Doubletree, and they call the parent companies nefarious enablers of the problem. They have these corporate programs where they teach their employees how to spot it, how to report it, how to avoid it, you know, literally down to the level of if there are a lot of condoms in trash cans, things like that, signs to look for when you're cleaning rooms. If that's not trickling down, then there's somebody has to be held accountable.
Well, the question is, companies can have corporate policies all day long. They're not legally bound to those corporate policies, right? So there has to be some kind of theory of why these major corporations should be held liable for what their franchisers are doing. I mean, not every McDonald's is owned by the McDonald's Corporation. So do you hold the major company, the mothership, liable for what's happening at the local level? Isn't that sort of what's happening here?
I think that they can withdraw their name. I mean, they can say, you can't be part of our chain anymore if this is going on. There can be consequences.
So what exactly are these plaintiffs hoping that the court will ultimately do?
I think it's early days, but they're civil lawsuits brought by the three women, by a law firm that has pursued lawsuits against truck stop chains, against Facebook, for some of its software that makes it easier for traffickers to find young women. And so it's a legal strategy that I've been in some of the hearings related to the Facebook case, and they're fascinating arguments, and they're complicated arguments, and judges have to go through a tangle of legal facts to try to decide who's responsible.
So how are these cases going to proceed? Has there a time frame been given, and what could these cases ultimately mean for people who've been victims of sex trafficking?
I mean, it's far too early to predict where this is going or how strong of a lawsuit it is. I can only say that the law firm that brought these charges, and there's a series of law firms working together, but the lead law firm has done a lot of work in this area.
So what's been the response so far from the hotel chains themselves?
They have very, very vociferously spoken about their policies against human trafficking and wanting to educate people. The two that responded to me, it was a story over the holidays, and two of the three chains got back to me with very, very strong statements about their policies and no comment on the case, which is typical. And so it'll just be interesting to see what happens in court. I think that what they've argued in all of the other lawsuits against the little mom-and-pop franchises is, you know, they throw their hands in the air and say, we're not responsible. Exactly what you're saying.
Gabrielle Banks covers federal courts for the Houston Chronicle, and she continues to follow these interesting cases. Gabby, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, it's a Tuesday, and what are Texans talking about? Let's find out by checking in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, sir.
Hello, David. Perhaps no surprise, but tensions in the Middle East high after the Trump administration assassinated a high-ranking Iranian general via drone, with many people asking what's next in the region. You know, that confusion appeared exacerbated when the U.S. looked like it was ready to withdraw all of its troops from neighboring Iraq, cited the drone strike. For about an hour yesterday, Pentagon officials themselves seemed confused about the release of this official U.S. letter, which stated U.S. forces would be repositioned in the region and many removed from Iraq, as that nation's parliament has requested. It wasn't until yesterday's briefing was over that the Joint Chiefs General Mark Milley returned to the press briefing room to clarify that the letter in question was only a draft, and there were no plans to withdraw U.S. forces.
Sounds like one of those situations now, where you hit the send button before you think
exactly.
You're ready to, right?
Yeah, drop something in the wrong Slack Ouch. Channel or something. It's an example of the growing instability in the region after the killing of that Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. On our Facebook page, Rachel K.G. Miller is concerned that ineptitude in Washington will kill people and says we have no national security. Randy Smith echoes those concerns, talking about the sheer amount of turnover that's occurred under President Trump and the sort of, I guess, so-called brain drain you could describe with many people leaving their posts.
There's a real tension between transparency and something that actually Mr. Trump referred to during his candidacy, and that was not wanting to show his hand when it came to military strategy and policy.
Yeah, with regard to the, I guess, the imminent, so-called imminent threat that the Iranian general represented.
So watch this space. In
yeah,
words.
Definitely more to come there. Well, you know, we're continuing to hear about our chat earlier in the show with the one Beto O'Rourke and his new political action committee out there to promote Democratic candidates in 2020. Mm-hmm. Via Twitter, Voxy Populi, she says, I appreciate the optimism Beto has, but I don't know anyone who can name someone running against Cornyn. That has to change really soon. Of course, I think you and I could, but we are, political junkies here on the Standard.
Yeah.
And one of those candidates ran into a little trouble over the weekend with some reporting on comments she made at a fundraising event. On our Facebook page, Robert Flood says this about Beto's new PAC. He says any efforts to promote voting from either side should be praised. So there's that.
Someone thought that I was asking Beto to run for Senate. Did
I
you
saw
see that?
That. I did.
I didn't ask Beto to run for Senate.
The final deadline's passed, man.
I did not ask Beto to run for Senate. Let's just be clear. Now, what I did ask him, though, was, I mean, there have been a lot of Democratic politicos who have said if he were to have made the choice to run for Senate, that would probably put a recognizable Texas Democratic figure on a name that has a lot, someone who has a lot of name recognition, right? And that means coattails. And that means people are excited about going to the polls to support their party. And so the question was from the standpoint of he had a decision to make and he chose to take this path.
Yes.
And he explained that the reason that he chose that path was because he felt like at the national level, he could accomplish more.
Beto Twitter keeps a watchful eye, David.
Don't you know it. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but keep your comments coming to us. Just look for Texas Standard on the social media platform of your choice, and Wells Dunbar will continue to look for your words of wisdom. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.